The World Health Organization says the population in Gaza is starving to death amid constraints on the delivery of humanitarian aid and continued Israeli strikes. The leader of the Ansarullah movement vows that Yemen's anti-Israel operations will continue until the genocidal war in Gaza ends. Plus, Iran kicks off the 10-day nationwide celebrations marking the 45th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. This is News. It's good to have you with us. Nearly 4 months into Israel's genocidal war on the Gaza Strip, the Palestinian Red Crescent says the regime forces opened fire and stormed their headquarters for a third time. Heavy Israeli attacks were reported near the Al-Amal Hospital in Khan Yunis, which is also the Red Crescent's headquarters. Both Al-Amal and Nasser hospitals have been under Israeli siege and target of Israeli tank fire for more than a week. Palestinian medics said that rescue teams from the hospitals cannot respond to desperate calls from people caught in the Israeli bombardment. Gaza's health ministry has warned that the medical system is at risk of collapse in Khan Yunis. There are also reports of Palestinians fleeing to the southern town of Rafah, which is already overcrowded despite the lack of a safe passage. The overall death toll from the Israeli aggression has now passed 27,000, mostly women and children. The Israeli genocide in the Gaza Strip has led to mass displacement of Palestinians. They've been forced to take shelter in tents or severely damaged structures without basic amenities and remain in constant fear for their lives. Let's take a listen to harrowing stories of Palestinians in the Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza.
We live in this destroyed building. We live here in fear, which is not only due to the Israeli forces, but also because the building could fall on us. 2 days ago, the roof of the bathroom collapsed on a man inside the building, causing major head injuries and leaving him unconscious. And a child was also injured. But we have no other place or other choice.
We try to find anything to feed our children. Flour is very scarce and its price is very high. Our life here is very difficult after the Israeli forces stormed our neighborhood, destroyed it, and arrested many of us. When we returned, we did not find any place to take shelter. Even the donkeys were killed and the carts were destroyed as well.
This bread is uneatable, but mothers have no choice but to give it to their children. For almost 7 days, my children haven't eaten bread. There is no flour.
The World Health Organization warns of the risk of starvation to death among the Gaza population due to constraints on the delivery of humanitarian aid to the war-ravaged besieged strip.
The risk of famine is high and increasing each day, with persistent hostilities and restricted humanitarian access. The WHO continues to face extreme challenges in supporting the health system and health workers. As of today, over 100,000 Gazans are either dead, injured, or missing and presumed dead. WHO has faced great difficulty even to reach hospitals in southern Gaza. During a UN mission on Monday, WHO delivered medical supplies to Nasser Medical Complex. Other missions to deliver fuel and food were denied. Despite challenges, Nasser Hospital continues to offer health services, although at reduced capacity. The hospital is operating with a single ambulance. Donkey carts are being used for transporting patients. Yesterday, we made another attempt to get food to Nasser, but due to delays about 500 meters from the checkpoint, the food was taken from the trucks by crowds who are also desperate for food.
The UN Aid Agency for Palestinians say that international funding cuts may force a shutdown of operations across the region by the end of February. Director of the Communications at UNRWA has made the comments as the agency's operations face uncertainty due to the suspension of funding by several Western donor countries. The suspensions came after Israel accused some UNRWA employees of involvement in Hamas's Al-Aqsa flood operation on October 7. This is while the UN chief has called the organization's Palestinian Refugee Agency the backbone of aid delivery to Gaza. The UN's humanitarian affairs chief has also stressed that Gaza is completely dependent on UNRWA being adequately funded and operational. The people in Gaza are already suffering from a lack of food, water, and basic supplies. The international medical charity Doctors Without Borders has issued yet another warning, saying the people in Gaza are facing a massacre. The head of the charity's mission for the Palestinian territories also expressed regret about MSF's inability to help Gazans in the current circumstances.
The first of all demands is an immediate and sustained ceasefire, because right now what is happening is a massacre. As I say, when I was in Nasser Hospital, I stayed one night there. There was an airstrike 150 meters from the hospital. It killed 8 people, including 2 children aged 4 and 5, little boys aged 4 and 5. There is a whole part of the population that needs humanitarian aid and does not have access to it. So we are being prevented from bringing this humanitarian aid to this population, which is also prohibited under international law. Since the start of the war, there have been systematic attacks against health facilities, and that too is unheard of at MSF, which leads us to say that it is the health system as a whole which has been clearly targeted by military operations.
Hezbollah resistance movement has carried out new operations against Israeli positions as the exchange of fire continues along Lebanon's southern border. The resistance fighters fired a barrage of missiles from southern Lebanon, targeting an Israeli radar site in the occupied Sheba farms. Hezbollah operations come amid bombings by Israeli warplanes on areas in southern Lebanon. On Tuesday, Hezbollah fighters launched missiles on the Israeli town of Matula. Hezbollah says its anti-Israel operation are in response to the regime's genocidal war in Gaza and in support of the Palestinian people. The leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement vows to continue the targeting of Israeli-bound ships in the Red Sea until the regime ends its genocidal war and lifts the siege on the Gaza Strip. Abdul Malik al-Houthi said that Israel and its Western backers must realize that they cannot break the resolve of the Yemeni people. Al-Houthi also touched upon the continuation of Israeli aggression against Palestinians in the wake of the recent ICJ ruling. He noted that the international institutions cannot make just and effective decisions regarding Israeli crimes due to American influence. Al-Houthi added that the West's moral bankruptcy is evident in the recent move to cut funding for the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees. He also slammed Arab countries for exporting goods to the Israeli regime, calling it an act of betrayal, as Palestinians are starving to death in the besieged Gaza Strip.
Hours after targeting the American destroyer USS Gravely in the Red Sea, the spokesman for the Yemeni Armed Forces, Yahya Saria, announced the successful targeting of the U.S. commercial ship Koi, which was heading to the occupied ports of Palestine with several naval missiles.
The naval forces of the Yemeni army carried out a military operation targeting an American commercial ship that was heading to the ports of occupied Palestine with several suitable naval missiles that directly hit it. This operation comes only hours after the naval forces of the Yemeni army targeted the American destroyer USS Gravely with several naval missiles in the Red Sea. The hit was direct and accurate, thanks to God.
Experts say that conducting two operations within hours serves as evidence that the US-UK aggression against Yemen has failed to undermine the capabilities of the Yemeni army or halt their naval operations. Instead, the ongoing Western aggression will expand Yemeni operations even further. Following the Yemeni naval attacks, the U.S. and U.K. carried out a fresh round of airstrikes against several positions in the capital Sana'a and other cities. U.S. officials said the attack was carried out using F-18 fighter jets launched from an American military base in Bahrain.
Observers highlight that the Yemeni naval operations go beyond displaying military strength. Rather, seen as a humanitarian, ethical, and religious duty to stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people, they assert that Western aggression will not dissuade Yemeni naval attacks, which are expected to cease only when Israel halts its genocidal war in Gaza. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Angry farmers have clogged the roads around the European Union headquarters with their heavy-duty tractor as the bloc's leaders have gathered in Brussels for a summit. Protests against agriculture-related policies first started in France have now spread to other European countries, including Belgium. National governments scrambled to address farmers' concerns, and the EU Commission announced new measures on Wednesday, but farmers say the measures are not enough to address their problems. They are angry over cheap food imports, especially from Ukraine. Farmers are also demanding government action on low price for their products, green regulations, and free trade policies. The uproar has widened across the continent, including Spain, Germany, Poland, Romania, and Italy. Farmers coming to Brussels on Thursday have been insisting their protests will be peaceful and that security forces have handled the protests lightly so far. Max Chivoli, our correspondent, joins us from Rome, and we also have Greg Simmons, who's an independent researcher and author, who joins us from Uppsala over in Sweden. All right, welcome to you both. Max, over to you first. We know that the voices are being heard from the farmers and the EU headquarters. I'm sure, even though it was not on their agenda, they obviously must have discussed a few things about this. There have been some concessions, but it doesn't sound like it's enough. So, and this is a huge, vast of problems that the farmers are experiencing. Tell us the latest that you have on this.
Well, protests have continued across Italy today. Clearly, the competition here is between the European family farming, so the small and medium farming companies, and the large agri-food corporations, the multinationals. With the latter trying to take control of the entire European agri-food supply chain. This is what some farmers I've met today in Rome told me. They are also saying that the umpire in this competition, namely the European Commission, is all but impartial. Over the past weeks, farmers across Europe and now also in Italy have been protesting against years of, quote, atrocious agricultural policies implemented by Brussels. And they say that they don't feel protected at all. They're saying that these measures are only protecting large agri-food corporations. Yes, there have been concessions from Brussels to farmers. They have announced, the European Union has announced a delay in green rules. But having said that, the situation doesn't change much for farmers. The European Commission has described this decision as a way to soften, to ease the tension, citing flooding, wildfires, heat waves across southern Europe, and drought in Spain as a reason for the huge drop in profits for farmers. But the farmers are saying, which that's not the cause. Farmers are saying that it's the huge price of energy, inflation, the cost of fodder, the cost of forage, all these have gone up. The price of all this has gone up big time lately due to the war in Ukraine, due to the tensions in the Middle East. So those are completely different views on the matter. We have the European Union on one side and the farmers on the other.
Yeah, Greg Simmons, obviously there's so many problems that are involved here that it would take more than a program to discuss all of this. But basically the bottom line is you have a product, you want to sell it, they're not making the money. And it's not even about low margins. I think they're not even making ends meet. So they can't sustain this type of, cycle to just live off of invoices that are payable, but yet they're in the negative territory. This is what the feeling I'm getting based on some of the case studies that I've read. So the government has to step in. But what can they do if they're looking at all these problems that, in a sense, have accumulated over the years? And one of the biggest ones, I'm guessing, would be, there's so many, the rising energy costs as a result of the fallout from the Ukraine-Russia conflict.
Well, I don't see how it's going to be reduced because, I mean, Western global liberals have an absolutely consistent track record of failures in creating crises and not managing the crises, and the crises come back again. This is one of them. I think one of these problems, which is beyond what you said, is that they follow an ideological path. They're not following common sense. They're not following, if you want to use the term, the science What they're following is ideology. So this Greta Thunberg stuff, this New Green Deal and so forth. And, of course, they are also following what the United States tells them to do with regards to Ukraine. So, I mean, you have all of these things, as you rightly say, they're coming together, they're coalescing with the inflation, cost of energy, all of these different things are coming together. But I think the ideology is the thing that's going to kill it, because they're committed to this, all these empty slogans like net zero and all of these things. And they do, and like ideologues, they do not care who gets harmed in the process, because it's the ideology that is important, no matter what the cost.
All right, thank you very much, Greg Simmons, independent researcher and author. Max Civelli, thank you so much, a correspondent there from Rome. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in. Iranics kicked off the 10-day Fajr ceremonies marking the 45th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. The annual nationwide celebration started all over Iran on Thursday, symbolically marking the date of the homecoming of the late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini. Imam Khomeini spent more than 14 years in exile, mostly in the Iraqi holy city of Najaf. He also spent some time in Turkey and also in France before returning to Iran. Millions of people converged on the capital from across the country on the day of his return. His arrival gave considerable momentum to popular protests against the U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime, which eventually led to its overthrow 10 days later. During the Fajr celebrations, Iranians take part in different events and activities to mark the occasion. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. Thank you so much for being with us. It's bye-bye for now.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
Donald Trump has come out against a draft resolution by the Republican National Committee declaring him presumptive nominee of the Republican Party. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. The Republican National Committee has pulled a resolution to consider declaring Donald Trump the party's presumptive 2024 nominee before he formally clinches the requisite number of delegates, a person familiar with the decision said on Thursday, 25th of January. News of the withdrawal came shortly after Donald Trump posted on his Truth Social site that, while he greatly appreciated the notion, he felt, for the sake of party unity, that they should not go forward with this plan, but that I should do it the old-fashioned way and finish the process off at the ballot box. The measure, according to a draft obtained on Thursday by the Associated Press, had said it declares President Trump as our presumptive 2024 nominee for the office of President of the United States, and from this moment forward moves into full general election mode, welcoming supporters of all candidates as valued members of Team Trump 2024. The withdrawal was confirmed by a person familiar with the decision who was not authorized to publicly discuss the matter. If approved, the measure would have further solidified Trump's control of the Republican Party and its operation at a time when former United Nations Ambassador Nikki Haley is still competing against him for the GOP nomination. Republican National Committee Chair Ronna McDaniel had earlier signaled her favoring the resolution. On Tuesday, after Nikki Haley finished second place to Trump in New Hampshire, McDaniel said that while she felt the former ambassador had run a great campaign, Republicans need to unite around our eventual nominee, which is going to be Donald Trump. It was expected that the resolution would be discussed by the RNC's winter meeting in Las Vegas next week, even though only two states have voted and the former president has nowhere near the requisite number of delegates to secure the nomination. Nikki Haley's camp said on Thursday, 25th of January, that it wasn't up to the Republican National Committee to decide who GOP nominee would be. Who cares what the RNC says? We'll let millions of Republican voters across the country decide who should be our party's nominee, not a bunch of Washington insiders, said Nikki Haley campaign spokesperson Olivia Perez-Cubas. The Associated Press has a policy to not refer to any candidate as the presumptive nominee until he or she has captured the number of delegates needed to win a majority vote at the National Party conventions this summer. The earliest that could happen is March. But there were no party rules prohibiting the Republican National Committee, the RNC, from making such a move. If it had been adopted, it could have given the Republican Party a jump start on planning a general election matchup with President Biden, who has begun framing his re-election campaign as a 2020 rematch against Donald Trump. There was also precedent for the committee to declare a candidate the presumptive nominee before winning the 1,215 requisite delegates to clinch the nomination. Then RNC chair Rince Priebus did so with Donald Trump in May of 2016. Despite losing both the Iowa and New Hampshire contests to Trump, Nikki Haley has argued that her performance, outlasting all the other Trump rivals, shows the strength of her candidacy. Trump currently has 32 delegates to Nikki Haley's 17. There is one delegate left to be assigned after the New Hampshire contest. During a rally on Wednesday night in her home state of South Carolina, Nikki Haley, the former governor of South Carolina, noted that her campaign had brought in more than $1 million since her second-place finish in New Hampshire. Trump followed up with a remark that appeared aimed at intimidating her donors. "Anybody that makes a contribution to Bird Brain from this moment forth will be permanently barred from the MAGA camp," Donald Trump wrote, using the nickname he has crafted for Nikki Haley and the abbreviation for his Make America Great Again slogan. "We don't want them and we will not accept them because we put America first and always will." Nikki Haley's campaign said on Thursday, 25th of January, that it raised an additional $1.2 million after Trump's unhinged pledge to permanently bar any individual who contributed to Haley's campaign. Donald Trump's threats highlight the stark choice in this election, personal vendettas or real conservative leadership, said Haley spokesperson Anne-Marie Graham Barnes. Trump's scheme blew up in his face. The contributions to the Haley campaign are pouring in, proof that people are sick of the drama and are rallying behind Nikki's vision for a strong and proud America. Donald Trump's dismissal of any Haley donors had no effect on T.J. Petrizzo, a former top Capitol Hill staffer and now a top lobbyist who supports Nikki Haley. "That's something out of a Godfather movie. Never betray the family. Come on," he added. "You've got to play this through." CNN, Cable News Network, has also covered the same story. A Republican National Committee draft resolution that would have formally declared Donald Trump the Republican Party's 2024 presumptive nominee was withdrawn on Thursday, 25th of January, amid pushback from the former president. David Bossi, the Republican National Committee committee man from Maryland, who recently endorsed Trump and introduced the resolution, withdrew it, according to two sources familiar with the matter. The Trump campaign had initially approved going forward with the resolution, and the former president himself was also on board until a backlash began. Donald Trump said on his social media platform on Thursday, 25th of January, that the Republican National Committee should not move forward with the resolution, saying he appreciated the effort but was opposing it for the sake of party unity and wanted to finish the process off at the ballot box. His statement came amid concerns from Trump allies that the resolution could anger Republicans because of the perception that Trump was trying to stack the deck against former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, a source close to the former president declared. While the former president would have still needed to reach the delegate requirements necessary to win the nomination if the resolution had been approved and the RNC had shifted to a general election mode, he would have access to the RNC's data operation, benefit from fundraising with the Republican National Committee, and have the support of all the committee's ground operations. It would also have meant the committee would have been supporting Trump and effectively opposing Nikki Haley, an unprecedented break from the party's past approach to the nominating process. A draft copy of the resolution was obtained independently by CNN. Resolved that the Republican National Committee hereby declares President Trump as our presumptive 2024 nominee for the office of President of the United States, and from this moment forward moves into full general election mode, welcoming supporters of all candidates as valued members of Team Trump, the resolution read. An RNC spokesperson said in a statement that this resolution was still just a resolution and not the stance of the committee. Resolutions such as this one are brought forward by members of the RNC. Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel doesn't offer resolutions, Communications Director Keith Schipper said in a statement. Keith Schipper added, "This will be taken up by the Resolutions Committee and they will decide whether to send this resolution to be voted on by the 168 RNC members at our annual meeting next week." The Nikki Haley campaign brushed off the resolution and said, "Republican Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel should organize a debate ahead of the South Carolina primary at the end of February." Who cares what the RNC says? We'll let millions of Republican voters across the country decide who should be our party's nominee, not a bunch of Washington insiders, a spokeswoman for Nikki Haley, Olivia Perez-Cubas, said in a statement.
Welcome, everyone, to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi, and today it's my pleasure to welcome to this program Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki. Stay tuned.
Sheikh Ibrahim Yaqub Zakzaki is a prominent Muslim scholar and a leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria. and the 1970s, during the peak of communist activism on university campuses around the world, he proposed a different path as an activist, and that is Islam, which he said could be the path forward for all aspects of life. He founded the Islamic movement in Nigeria in the 1980s while still at the university. It was a small grassroots movement. However, the organization has now grown to have millions of followers. Some estimates state that as many as 20 million people are part of the Islamic movement in Nigeria now. Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki says that his movement has been successful because its main message has been one of fighting oppression and having sovereignty over one's own land and resources.
Thank you so much for joining me today on Hidden Files, Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki. I'd like you to give us some short points about the highlights of your life that got you from being a college student or a young student to then the leader of the Islamic movement of Nigeria.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa sallallahu ala sayyidina wa nabiyyina Muhammadu wa ala tayyibina tahirin ma'asum. Personally, I don't like to speak about myself. I would prefer that others speak on my own.
But who better to speak about what you've done?
Well, presently, I'm 70 years old. I was born May 1953. Early life was studied in local Islamic schools, according to traditional way. My father was a Quranic teacher, so I started learning from him. And learning from, rudimentary, but up to the level of, memorizing some parts, and then he delivered me to another Quranic school. Then we have what we call, after Quranic school, we start what we call book school. That's why I start learning from book. It includes all different subjects in Islam, ranging from Tawheed, theology, fiqh, jurisprudence, luga, that's language, literature, and so many other subjects. All the books are in Arabic. You will read it in Arabic, and there will be translation in a local language and explanation in local language.
So you were always interested in Islamic studies?
Traditionally, that's what we're doing. And I attended different schools from different sheikhs, because normally at one time these schools do not look like the Hausa, we used to study from the houses of the sheikhs. They have school, but the teacher would be only one, teaching different subjects from the beginning to up to a certain level. So normally you change from one teacher to another. You learn fiqh from one, you go for another to for literature, you go for to another for other subjects. That's what we used to. So by sometime in 1969, I was 16 then, I started what you might be called formal education. There was a school called School for Provincial Arabic School. This is a place where the then local authority was teaching, training those who will teach in the primary school, who will teach Arabic and Islamic studies. So I was there for about 2 years, 1969-1970. There were 71 to 75, I was in a college in a different city. Formerly I was born in Zaria, that's why I started studying. And I went to a provincial Arabic school for Arabic studies in Kano. Okay, the School of Arabic Studies in Kano has two sections. One is called grade two teachers, Kismar Ma'alimin, the teacher section in Arabic. And the other one is called higher Muslim studies. This is mostly is in Arabic solely. But the other one, one will study also in English language. It's like any other secondary, English language, mathematics, geography, history, all in English language.
Right.
In addition, there will be Arabic and Islamic studies, but it is like any other college. The only addition is that it's Arabic language, which is compulsory, and the Islamic studies, which is also compulsory. All right.
So out of all of your studies, what was key, you think, in creating the Sheikh Zakzaki that we know today?
At that time, I was just been trained as a teacher, for example. After I finished school in 1975, I started as a teacher. But during my study in those 5 years, I was also interested in subjects that were not being taught in the school. So I started privately to study them. This included government, economics,
That was key.
I was interested in 1974, I sat for examination in ordinary level of in those subjects. And in 75, after finishing school, as a trained teacher for primary school, successful training. So I also, at the same year, sat for advanced level in 4 different subjects. That's the maximum advanced level one can take. That would include government, economics, Islamic studies, and I think Hausa language. That's the maximum. I also studied Islamic history, advanced level, but I did not write the examination. So success in those 2 examinations qualified me to start a degree course a year later. In 76. Mm-hmm. So from 76 to 79, I was studying BSc Economics in a famous university in my own hometown,
Right.
So those late 70s, in the university, it was ideological conflict. There were communists. Many of the teachers, particularly in the Faculty of Social Sciences, were communists.
There was a lot going on in the world in the 70s.
And then there were people who were divided into 3. There was people who were satisfied with the status quo, mostly Christians, because Christians are not advocating anything. And then there was those who think that there should be change, but that should be in the form of communism. And there are few of us who felt that Islam was also an ideology which can also be used to establish a society and the social justice, the communists are calling, but it will be found in Islam.
Well, let me just stop you there, because especially in the 70s, that was the time of communists, as you said, socialist movements. Mm-hmm. And we know that we hadn't had, like, a successful Islamic state. So, but you had studied economics and other aspects, jurisprudence. What made you think that could be key to solving a lot of the problems that people were going through?
I have a background of Islamic studies. I have studied Islam a lot, all what they traditionally used to learn in those years. In that time, I have always studied it. And those who are calling for communism, they are calling for social justice, but they have problem with religion. They equate Islam with Christianity. They think that whatever happened in the history of Christianity in Europe, they now come and apply it on Islam. They know nothing about Islam. Just Karl Marx called religion as the opium of the people. So Karl Marx has no knowledge of Islam at all. He was talking about Christianity as he knew it. So I said, look, you don't know Islam. Whenever they are talking about Islam, they talk about the Umayyad dynasty or the Abbasid jinn dynasty, and there was a revolution in Nigeria 100 years before the coming of the colonialists, and later on, it was established of emirates. So those emirs were in control of those emirates. And then they always cite emirs and what they were doing as if that was Islam.
Right.
And they attack Islam a lot. So we were defending Islam. We said, look, Islam can supply social justice much more than what you think.
Mm-hmm.
But what you equate Islam with Christianity is not the same. They have so different history. You can't apply what you know about Christianity on Islam. You have to study Islam in its own right. So at that time, of course, we knew nothing about the calling of Imam Khomeini. We didn't know anything about it. But there was this ideological conflict until late 70s when the Islamic Revolution came up.
So then it's 1979, revolution, in Iran took place. What happened? What was it? Because you had been talking about, as a student, and talking about the possibility of establishment of Islam as a state or a state of government or total way of life. So then the revolution takes place in Iran. What did you feel when this took place?
It gave us a hope. It showed that what we were yearning and aspiring, which others were saying it was not possible in the present time. In fact, they were saying that Islam was established before and it ruled the world before, but it is not capable of ruling the present day life, a world which is sophisticated in science and technology. They think that Islam is a bygone. It has ruled in India and that's all.
Yeah.
So the Islamic revolution in Iran changes the thing. You see, it has practically come to life. So it gave us hope. And then we were now all, happy yourselves. So you see what you think that cannot happen in the modern time has happened elsewhere. So it can also happen where we are. An impactable part of the world is possible. What they were thinking, it was impossible, it became possible.
Mm-hmm.
So that, of course, we were thinking that it was possible, but that some may say, how are you going to have army to fight? Or are you going to, you join the system and change it at the top? Or, make a political party, Islamic political party or anything of that sort.
Right.
And then join election and win. Now, the way of Imam has shown it, if you have the people change. The revolution is not a change of a government.
Right.
It is change of people, a change of attitude of people. And it has practically happened in Iran. Alhamdulillah, that shows. Immediately we showed all our allegiance and support to the Islamic revolution and the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Right. Now, we get into the establishment of the Islamic movement of Nigeria, and it's really interesting because you have a whole wide range of individuals, even those who are not Muslims. Some of them, from what I understand, may not even be religious. And, of course, Sunni and Shia, part of this movement. What is key in that? What do you teach that it's all-encompassing, bringing all types of people to the way?
All people like justice, and they do not like injustice. Nobody wants oppression. And, we're under oppression of some sort. Our country has been colonized by the British. And the British, continue to control those in authority. And they continue also to tap our resources for their own use, so we felt that we are not fully independent. We are only, we have been made to be a state under a certain empire. So, another thing is, the puppets they have established, they are always after themselves, and that's why the communists were calling for social justice, And now we are seeing that, but Islam has provided a model in the time of the Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And then you have a new model now in modern time, the Islamic Republic of Iran. So, we are calling people to come together and act against common enemy, a common ideology. We call it oppression. Everybody should be
against colonialism.
This attracts, those who are former communists. But communism, when it dwindled in the 80s, all those who were advocating, a lot of those who were advocating for communism turned to Islam, And the Christians, think that we are only the people who show it. We do what we say, They think that they can trust what we are saying. But they cannot trust others, even though they may be Muslims. But they may use Islam for their own use. But they feel that we are actually doing what we are saying, and they believe that we are actually honest what we are doing. So this attracts them as well. And of course, we try to shun anything that will divide people. We are not so sectional in what we are doing. Even though those who attack us, they always try to marginalize and call us we are just from the society. But our activities and our relation to the people show the contrary. So this is what actually makes it possible for us to go along with all the people. And we are not against anyone, and we can go along with anyone.
As we're speaking, it's close to the anniversary of the Zaria massacre that took place. And knowing the story of what happened, I want to look at it from a different angle, because we saw the dedication of the brothers and sisters during that situation, trying to stand up for what they believe, also protecting you. What is key to that belief system that they're willing to give their lives for what they feel is the truth? Just tell me, as far as the Islamic movement in Nigeria itself, what has happened that we see this type of dedication to Islam?
Zaria massacre was myself the height of attacks we had and persecution we have, but it all through since the early 80s. For the last 40 years, we have been under different persecutions. So as time is moving, I said that, for example, in the 70s, we are very few. There was a time we will gather in a masjid and we will give a plain pulse cap sheet for everybody to write his name. And the last number may be 25, and we'll be surprised that so many people have come. And this 25 have come from different parts of the country. And then this, on it was increasing and a number, and it becomes from tens to hundreds to thousands and so on. And the persecution, the Southern Authority, even since with the time we were in the universe in the late 70s, there was seeing that as far as they were concerned, that was a danger, and they started, the persecution started right from that time. And it went through until, there were different persecutions in different forms, including imprisonments. They now come to the conclusion that they have to deal with us once and for all, and it started in our way, kill. Now, coming to your question, people have built faith slowly. They built faith, and they have learned a lot from the examples of the sacrifice of Ahlul Bayt, particularly during the times of Ashura, from this 10 days, and it increases to 40 days, and all the whole of Muharram and all the whole of Safar, these 2 months, we spend them all still, making, commemoration of what has happened to the family of the Prophet. And whatever happens to you is just, you feel it is so little compared to the sacrifice of the Ahlul Bayt. And that's, we draw inspiration from that. And we also draw inspiration from the stand of the Islamic Revolution also, where people stood by, supported the Imam. And that's how, faith built in people. Some people, they make some different accusations, and they say maybe it is because you indoctrinate people, or they think that there is any other we use finance or something of that sort. So you better say that these people are mad. Unless you say you are mad, they are not out, they are out of their senses. That will be the case if they are out of their senses, okay, or if they have been drugged to behave the way. But what you will see is an outcome of faith and dedication and sacrifice. And this is so little when compared to what the family of the Prophet have suffered through the history. And we draw inspiration from that.
Well, when we look at Islamic movement in Nigeria, I mean, we see, I just talked about Zaria, but also we see every year and people dedicated on the Day of Quds, and going out, and usually there are some martyrs just about every year. I want to know, in the middle of the situation as far as your own problems that exist in Nigeria, what was key for you that Quds would be commemorated in that way?
Well, since the time the Imam, late Imam Quddus Sirru has declared the last Friday of Ramadan for showing solidarity with Palestine, we also started doing it, but in a little way. We started doing it with demonstrations with very few people. And after the demonstration, we gather and have lectures for 2 or 3 days. And we started, it was not possible at the beginning, we start to do it in Ramadan, because we have to bring people to come from different parts of the country to participate. So we were doing it immediately after Ramadan, the first Friday after Ramadan. And some people even say, why should you do it? They say, well, if we did the last Friday of Ramadan, only few people will attend. So we started with first Friday after Ramadan. Mm-hmm. You know, people will be able to travel.
Right.
Until when the number becomes so large that we don't have to gather in one place. We can do it even in neighbor town. Then we said now we can celebrate it on the last day of Ramadan, and people don't have to come to one place. We used to gather all in Zaria. Mm-hmm. Until when the number becomes so large, we now said that every city should do it. But not every city, of course, larger cities. We selected about 22 cities. We said that it should take place in those places. And, unfortunately, the response from the authorities in Nigeria is always violent. Even though the demonstration has just peaceful demonstration, you see, but their response is always to come and sometimes abruptly, they will come and open fire. And so many times there will be nothing. You have no idea which time they will attack and which time they may not, and which town they may attack and which town they may not attack. So they were asking. Some people are asking us, how do you overcome this? So, well, these people have given us, a stand. They said, either you stop it, or we deal with you. So we are not stopping. Do whatever you may do, and we will never stop. And we tell them that Quds Day has come to stay until the liberation of Quds. We will never stop that demonstration, whether they put open fire or not. And that's what our answer to them. So that's how sometimes it goes well without any itch, And sometimes abruptly they just attack it. Alhamdulillah, it has been increasing. We formerly were not doing even in the federal capital, but now it is the largest gathering is in the federal capital now.
Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki, thank you so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for staying with us on another Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.